Dr. Callahan, Paloma, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me here.
I'd like to know why the Department of History decided to join the Global Languages and Theater Arts in presenting the Slitz documentary.
We're really interested in knowing more about Europe during the 1970s. We're interested in knowing about counterculture in Europe in the 70s. And I think there are a lot of people in our department in general that are just really interested in the music of the time period. And so that brought us to agreeing to work with Global Languages.
Well, I'm really excited, Paloma, to have you here, founding member
and
drummer of the Slitz, also for a brief time part of the Raincoats, another group that I have a lot of fondness for. So thanks for coming to Murray.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, Dr. Callahan, I think we'll be both asking Paloma some questions. Why don't you just start off wherever you think is appropriate?
Well, Paloma, I'd like to start with the easy question. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I was born in Spain, grew up in Malaga, big family, 9 brothers and sisters. I was number 8, and that's very significant because my parents were too busy with everybody else, and we had a lot of fun, like building forts and just being kids. We were really able to be kids for a long time. But Spain was under the dictatorship of Franco, and that is, like, people here in America don't know what being under someone that tells you what religion to be, like what political party or ideas to have. You couldn't read certain books. There were some movies people would run to France to be able to watch them. I mean, that's very foreign here in this culture. So, of course, I was very restless and curious and rebellious and just full of life, and I wanted to know that's not what I want. I also, like, experienced, like, you know, the machismo was very prevalent. Like, you know, like a woman, you know, the husband could do whatever. Actually, they would go by themselves to the bars, and the wife will stay home, and they will do whatever. And I from earlier on, I did not like that. So that is my background.
Well, what motivated you to move to London? There are a lot of cities all over Europe that you could have chosen. Why London?
London to me was like freedom. Like I would see this, not just from London, but Northern Europe, they will have all these hippies coming with the backpacks, and I would just like just to get up and go somewhere with a backpack. To me, that was like so romantic and so adventurous. But to me, like I just felt like if I went there, I could be myself. I could make my own life. I could break the shackles that I felt, you know, like as a woman. You know, and it wasn't so much a conscious decision. It was like a gut decision, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I just had to experience something different. Mm-hmm. That I was sure there was a different way of living. And London represented that to me.
Was language a barrier for you when you moved to London? Had you learned English prior to going?
For sure. And I'm actually a language teacher myself now. I didn't learn it quite the right. So basically, you just had hello, goodbye, but it did not do me any good when I got there. I could not even understand because it was everything done in paper. So initially it was, but it's amazing how quick you learn. Like, so I went to England for a short time, went back to the University of Madrid, and it wasn't very good. So it was just 6 months. Then I went back to London. From then on, I landed in a squat, and there was a lot of people, like, I don't know, 10 or so young people, and different squads were connected. And so it was the best school to learn because we would sit drinking tea. I don't know how many cups of tea we drink. And we talk. And actually, I just listened, basically, for probably. And I remember having this conversation sometimes when I drank and thinking, how did I have a conversation? I don't know English. That girl didn't know Spanish. But I just remember we had a great conversation the next day.
How long had you been in London before you met Joe Strummer?
Not that long, because he was in the squad that I arrived. So, and I was there. I had a boyfriend from Bolivia. He was into communism and that, but really only like intellectually. It's another story. But anyway, so I got there and then we broke up. So very soon after, Joe was really pursuing me. He was there. He had the 101ers. And I just thought he was just really like fun and carefree and charismatic. But a very gentle person, too. Like, it was very different to the Spanish macho guy.
Tell us about how he was your entry point into the music scene during the mid to late 70s in London, and about all the bands that you were kind of around for the genesis of.
So when I met him, he was in a rhythm and blues band. And I remember, so we got together, and I remember walking with him, and he was saying, he pointed to this pub, which was an Irish pub, out of all things. He said, one day we're going to play there. They were playing in this, like, rinkety, like, little, like, upstairs room, you know, that they rented for £1. So he said, one day we're going to play there. That was like an official play where real bands play. And I laughed because he was being, like, ambitious. And in my mind, you know, I came from a culture very politicized. And to me, that was childish. But I liked that he just said, well, he wanted to be, you know, like, he wanted to be famous. And I thought, oh, that's kind of funny, kind of cool. And so so he was very focused. Music was his first thing. And so we just, they would play, we would dance. My sister and I, Esperanza, you know, Richard Dudansky, who wrote a book about the whole thing. Squat City Rock, great book too, for that period, that transition. So they were playing together. Everything was the music. We get up, we make meals, we chatted, we were with friends hanging out. We lived from the dole. We had money. The squats, we didn't have to pay anything. I remember sparkles coming out of the wires because nobody really knew what they were doing, but someone knew a little bit more than everybody else, and they would connect the wires. And now I can see and laugh even on that. There's been some tragic thing happening in Northern California, which is terrible, but really could have been us. You know, so to us, it was a beautiful place. We didn't feel poor. We just have it like, so I go a little bit away from your question.
Was the Clash still on the horizon, or had they already started talking in terms of that actual band?
Okay, so they haven't started. After 2 years of the 101ers, I went away because I wanted a little space to, I said, you know, he's doing his thing. What am I doing with my life? You know, I felt like, so I said, you know what, I need to go. I need to have a space. At that time, I go to Scotland. The Sex Pistols play, and that was the ignition. So the Sex Pistols play, they actually break the equipment of the rival band to the 101ers. So it could have been the 101ers that they were supporting. Joe Strummer, so Woody, who was in the 101ers, changed his name to Joe Strummer. And he's mesmerized by what Johnny Rotten is saying, totally caught in the excitement of that. And he said, this is my way. This is what I want to do. So he gets right into it. I'm in Scotland. We were on the phone talking and that, but from time to time. And so I come back, and he's all into it. Everybody in the squad scene has rejected him because they say you are commercializing. And especially Richard had gone. He had invited him to the Clash. and they were friends. But when Richard heard, like, Bernie's spiel about you have to be this and you have to do that and you have to do that, he said, forget it. He was not interested. And I didn't like a lot. I didn't like that side. But the way I am, I thought, well, but I like that. I like that you can just get up. I kind of pick my own things. I felt sick and tired of being a hippie and lying down and then, you know, like lying, you know, and just smoking. And I felt like I needed a purpose. I said, I'm going to try this. So he goes right into it and I totally follow him. Like, I think, you know, this is cool. I was excited about him. So, okay, where are we going with it now?
I want to know about the beginning of the Slits and the fact that there were no female groups, period, especially playing this kind of music. And what shocked me was the violence that you had to face just to get on a tour bus or mm-hmm. to stay in a hotel. I can't even conceptualize what that must have felt like.
So, yeah, there was a lot of harassment and a lot of, like, we provoked something very, like, when especially guys, some guys, not everybody. So in the way it started, I met Ari in a gig at Patti Smith, and she was acting up, and I said, oh, I really like, she has no innovation. I asked her to be in a band. Then we got Tessa, eventually Vivian joining mm-hmm. afterwards. And so the way we dressed, we walked in the street, if we didn't do anything, we provoked, but we did do some things. Like we would go and scream at a bystander just for fun. We like just like full of ourselves and just walking and messing around. And sometimes we get a strong reaction. One time Ari got, cut through her coat with a knife. It's in the movie. Mm-hmm. I got punched in my eye one time. Like, it was like, because we were like, the man downstairs was selling vegetables or something, and we're practicing our songs, shoplifting and all that on the top room. So anyway, that created, and we were so different to what the way people, like people now see you dressing up crazy, a little crazy, and it's part of the fashion. Then nobody dressed like that. And even girls, like it was just like very something. It got a strong reaction.
London in the 70s was a dirty, depressed, economically place. And how do you see the movement of punk related to the social problems of London in the late 70s?
It was a reaction. It was a reaction. I mean, Johnny Rotten said, we are the flowers in the trash. There's no future in England's dream. There was definitely that element that, you know what, we are like, we don't want the culture. I wrote a song, New Town, where everybody goes around sniffing cocaína mm-hmm. or taking televisina. You know, they say we take drugs, but I say you take drugs. You just take a different kind of drugs. And we don't like the drugs you're taking. We like our ones. So we want to, our theme was, it was a reaction to that culture. We created our own culture by surrounding ourselves. So we were a group you could define as, you could see us in the street, in attitude. But the interesting thing is within that counterculture, there was a lot of different, I feel like as women, like what you were asking before, there was no role models. There was no other groups with girls that didn't sing. You know, usually they were just singing sweet songs and that. And there we are. Let's do the split. And I shit on it. Can I say shit?
Yeah. Okay.
So there was no role model. Like, so we would write, I was writing songs about shoplifting, Number One Enemy, and the New Town. Like, my initial songs were very aggressive. I feel as women, we were a revolution within a revolution. like, yes, the boys were like rebelling against some of the things of the larger culture, but then within the culture there was still some of the same elements. Like I was in a group with Sid Vicious, and I didn't last long. Basically, you know, we were practicing after he stays there. He says, you know, I hate blacks. He's like, oh, there was this thing of saying something antagonistic. You were more punk, if you know. And he was an icon, and he was like Sid Vicious. He was like top notch. He thought, okay, anyway. He was the status quo, really, within our little. It's so funny because you break out of a status quo and you create your own one. And so, but I wasn't going to have it. And so he said, I hate blacks. And I said, I hate people that hate blacks. And I was having a problem with, you know, me and Joe were a little rocky and, you know, like, why doesn't this guy just go? You know, like I was like all in turmoil inside my head. And then he's trying to act like. And basically the next time I see him, he said, I find out I'm out of the band because I didn't sleep with him. So I was upset, of course. And then I thought, I'm just going to form a girls band. That's where the idea came from, really. I don't want to deal with that. I want to have a band. I don't want to be in that position.
Well, tell us a little bit about the founding of the Slits. I know that you and Ariana formed the band, and then you developed it, but it's also really tightly related to the personnel of the Sex Pistols and the personnel of the Clash, and because you all were friends, and Ariana's stepfather is Johnny Lydon, right?
Or yeah, Johnny Rotten.
Yeah.
So, well, that came after. So at the time we met, so we were a small group, so we will hang out together. Paul Simenon is actually the one that gave me the name Palmolev. He was goofing around and said Palmolev. I told him my name. So, Ari's mom, Nora, was part of the scene, and she was like, you know, like just this really sweet, blonde, very, very blonde, fluffy sweaters. And we were all scruffy and that, but she had a nice home. And so we would go there and have meals. So it was a hanging out place, her home. Clean house, meals and that. So, and then the boys would go too, and so we would just hang out. So, sorry. So the question was?
The foundation.
So as I say, I met Ari Ajax, and then we started practicing. Kate Koros, who then went to the Modets, was the guitarist. And so actually the boys had a lot of influence because they were Shane Vivian. You know, we were already had play. So the boys said that, Vivian would look better or whatever, you know. So it was a lot about the image, you know. So anyway, we got Vivian. So the formation of it was just me there was a practice room in the squat that we would put mattresses around, you know. Everything was homemade. Our clothes were homemade. So the whole thing was this exciting thing. I called my dad. Dad, can you send me money? I never asked for money. I went to England on my own. And this is the first time I said, I needed £60 to buy this secondhand Joe Strummer. And I went to this house, bought this little drum set, stripped it, painted black, splash paint on it, and that was my drum set. And so we would just meet in this basement, and then you were in a squat. So from time to time, you just had to move. So we just moved the stuff and the mattresses and everything, and we just it was. So in the context, there was the poverty that you were talking. It was like very oppressive, and that oppression in our little world. We just felt we were exploding and able to be ourselves much more than maybe when I lived in my middle-class Spanish home. because we were defining ourselves. So there was, in a sense, we didn't feel it. Yeah, we were taught, we knew that we weren't given the same chances. Mm-hmm. And we knew that there was bad. Because being able to auto-define ourselves, we felt rich. We felt like, okay.
What's your fondest memory of playing with the Slits?
I remember one time in Holland, we were playing, and I don't know why, but if I had not taken anything, I just felt playing and hitting those drums, and I just feeling like I was flying. I just felt like I was flying. I was just like in the zone. I was just, everything was so like raw, and by that time we have gotten better, you know, like lots of times. At the beginning it was like we didn't know what we were playing. We were just, everybody, okay, go. And then sometimes we met in the song and sometimes we didn't.
How would you define your music historically?
How would I define my music? The best way I can capture the essence of punk and the beauty of punk to me is like when you see a little kid, for instance, and you give them paint. Here is red, here is blue, and here's the paper, and here's yellow on that. Go ahead, have fun. So there was my drum set. I will hit the tom, and when you hit, suddenly, like, it's something about the sound, the response of the drum. Like, it's just like a game. So to me, it's like that child being uninhibited, making this. I love kids' paintings. That's what I'm saying. So punk had that beauty. Eventually, it changed. We were getting better, and people like didn't want to be playing the same thing, right? It got old, so it was like a moment. It had like that improvisation, like no rules. Like you set your own rules, basically. Does that answer your question?
It does, and in some ways, it's like jazz. That it can be really improvisational. And you can move with the moment, and if you feel like you're flying, you can take it a different direction.
Right. Is that except accurate? We didn't have the expertise that jazz players have. So we just thumped the drums. Oh, that sounds good. Boom, boom, boom.
Before you came to London, did you have any idea that you would ever be a musician?
Never, never, ever, ever. Like, I never had any roles models. Like, in Spain, the people I like were basically counterparts of Bob Dylan. We didn't even have a drum vice in Spain. Like, it was all men. Mm-hmm. And so I always connected with their words, some of those words from the poets of 27, you know, and Machado and all of them, Antonio Machado, Alberti. What gripped me in those, I was to be obsessed with their music, and I just would listen to them, and it was their words more than the music, really, that attracted me, how they could say something and change my narrative. You know, I was brought up, you know, in a Catholic church, you know, like everybody was Catholic, whether you were or not, you just were. And so, yeah, so I had flamenco. I had no idea that I would be involved in music at all.
Did it surprise your parents?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have to give them credit. My dad was very machista, but he did send me the $60. He thought I was asking for $60 for pots, kitchen pots, because bateria is pots. But they did. One time I was on the television, and the Spanish television came to Portobello, and they said, "You have something to say?" And I said, "Yeah." And I stuck my tongue to the camera. So they were kind of mystified. I think they had like mixed feelings.
Yeah.
They definitely, you know, I'm sure they got a few calls from their friends.
Well, one of the things that touched me about the film when I was watching it was the fact that not long after the band really came together, the band didn't want you anymore. And so can you talk to us a little bit about, first of all, you're a founding member and, you know, they want you to hit the street. How did you feel and what do you think the motivation was?
Well, to put it in context, we were all very young and very crazy. So I did find it. I mean, of course, I felt rejected. I felt horrible. I felt like my world just was pulled from under me, you know, like this barrenness, like an injustice, you know, like a sense of that. But in the other sense, I can see, you know, like in a way they did me a favor because we were just what was happening at the beginning that was really cool. And it was another thing that was really cool. In the two groups I have in the Raincoats too, and the Raincoats actually were very significant as well in the movement. But when we used to come together, I would write a song or someone else, you know, and then we'll bring it and then we work together. It was a very democratic process, actually, which is really remarkable. Like, we were wild and that in the street, like, and then we come down and say, oh, no, how about this? Oh, but what about that? And that was like the honeymoon of the group, I feel. Like, that was the beauty. Like, they split in 81, we started at 76, okay? So 5 years altogether. So I was with them until 79. The whole time we were, we had eight managers. Like we just kicked them out or they ran away or something. So because we wanted to auto-determine ourselves. So what was happening is like we were four strong people with strong opinions, right? So all was well while we went along the same way. What happened when we didn't know how to handle differences? So the one significant one, it was like I felt Vivian was being very more bossy. And I don't like that. You know, I started like distancing myself. And then there was, so Malcolm McLaren wanted to manage us. And we knew like what had been happening a little bit. And I had this like intuition with him that I was a little wary of him. And then we met. We went to this bar. I remember he took us to a gay bar. And then he came up to me and said, oh, Shoplifting is the best song. And he's like laying it thick, you know. And I'm like looking at him like, okay, where are you going? And then we had another meeting after that. And he gave us his spiel, why he wanted to be our manager. And he said, I hate women and I hate music and I thrive in hate. And I'm like, they're all listening and we are like, oh, Malcolm, the icon of punk wants us. And they're like, and I am like, did you just hear that? So even if I identify with a lot of punk, I also, we had conversations growing up. I had something else. And I was a little older. Ari was 14 when I met her. You know, by that time, he probably was 15. Or maybe, you know. So I really disagree with that. And I managed to sway them. You know, in our conversation, okay, we don't go with Malcolm. Then we were about to, so we didn't want to sign with anybody. We didn't want to just do a crappy record. The only recording I did with them is the John Peel, the 77 and 78, which I think they're pretty good. I think that captured what the Slits were at the beginning. And so we were about to sign, and me and Vivian are not getting very well. And then there's the whole thing about the cover. They wanted us to have, you know, the idea came up that we will have the mat and the loins and that. And I dressed really, like, I mean, I seen pictures of myself. So, like, you could see everything. I was not modest. But to me, to put it on the record cover was like, no, that's like a pinup. That's not who, what we are about. Now, there's the thought behind that you the same way like Sid Vicious would say, we'll wear a swastika. I could not do that. I would not do that because I came from Franco. So in my context, that's not something, that's not a non-negotiable. Okay? In your face, yeah. Shocking, yes, but some things, and just you just don't cross that line. That's, and that was something for me. Now, all the others did not agree with me. So suddenly there was this issue, you're not in the beat, which is funny to me because afterwards was like the Rancor's broad thing, this thing that you is feminine to just if you want to speed or slow. So I remember going to Ireland and they put a metronome. Now, it's tense in the group. I'm not getting along. I know they're talking. And they put me a metronome. And anyway, I just, no, after that scene, we go away. And then I hear Tessa comes. Tessa was my friend. Tessa comes and tells me, you know, we decided to let you go. So it was a natural progression in a sense. We were just parting. Like, I think with the Rancors, for instance, we were together. We worked 6 months. And I realized that I wanted to take my life a different way. I said to them, you know, I can't do this. And they were very sad. But they say, how about we just put a record, do a record together and do the tour and then you go. And I say, okay. If we had been able to do that, I think it would have been better for Ireland. I think it's significant that Ireland just dropped them afterwards. You know, maybe, maybe not. But anyway, Alan probably knew the Slits the way we were. And then they went a different direction, which is totally okay. I think they did really great work afterwards. But they were expecting something else. And so I think it will have been more mature to see and say, okay, we're not getting along. Let's rethink this thing. Let's put down what we have done, the work we have done all these years. And then let's move on. So that was how it happened.
I want to know, how involved were you in the making of the documentary?
So a little bit. Like, so, of course, they came, they stay at my house, and they recorded. And then there was a few edits that I did suggestions. There was one that I thought, that's not... I know you have this other show, you know, so, and he was open, you know, I was open to change some things, but not too much, really. I mean, when people do that, even when you do an interview, you're at the hands. I do video editing. Mm-hmm. I know how much you put in yourself. So some of the things in the documentary, he wanted to see me playing the drums. The only drums was in a church. I had changed... my religious views, you know, like I was evolving. And so I don't think that's represented. Like a church with a steeple does not represent, I think. But it's not important. I mean, it's just, it's a photograph of that time, you know. But it could have been done different. Hey, my Mac shot.
But overall, is it a fair, does it paint a fair picture of the Slits and the scene and your personalities?
I think so. I think what I love is all the footage, the original footage. I love that it doesn't glorify, it says the whole story, like even with Ari at the end, like as sad as it mm-hmm. is, I think when you do history, it's good to tell the whole story. Like, you know, if you write about someone and you glamorize them, people don't learn from that. You know, you can glean more when it's something real, mm-hmm. I think. Which is why I also want to, so I feel like, yes, it does paint some things, okay. You know, I want to write my own book. I want to tell the story in my own voice.
We would like to read that book.
Okay, I'll let you know when I do it. I'm writing here bits and pieces, but I have to be more disciplined. And life happens, and you get busy. But I am in the process of doing it.
Well, that'll be great. I'm confident that there will be plenty of readers that will be interested in hearing more about the story and your particular involvement in really bringing the band together and the changes of music. You were living through those changes as punk evolved. And so I think that people will be very fascinated by your story.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.